This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled, Justice for Sale, How the Criminal Justice System Accommodates the Affluent and Influential While Coming Down Hard on the Poor.
Today, public concern about crime is greater than ever, even though many categories of crime are down. The clamor is for three strikes and you're in for life. So it's discomforting to discover that the criminal law is often written and enforced in the most tawdry class bias ways, favoring the rich over the rest of us. Even when the letter of the law is on their side, working people seldom have the time or money to seek redress with the courts. The very definition of what is or is not lawful contains a class bias. The theft of merchandise from a neighborhood store is unlawful, but the theft of the store itself and the entire surrounding neighborhood in an urban renewal program instigated by speculators, bankers, and public officials is hailed as an act of civic development. People fear street crime more than the white-collar variety because of the immediacy of its violence and its vivid portrayal in movies and television shows. But white-collar crime inflicts far greater monetary, environmental, and human costs. The National Association of Attorneys General estimates that white-collar fraud costs the nation $100 billion a year, a figure that doesn't include antitrust violations like price fixing, which may amount to as much as another $160 billion. In addition, corporations have looted worker pension funds of billions of dollars. A few years ago, the Labor Department found violations in one-third of all private pension plans. White-collar crime is not a rarity, but a regularity. Many companies are repeat offenders. The Justice Department found that 60% of the almost 600 largest U.S. companies were guilty of one or more criminal actions, be it tax evasion, price fixing, illegal kickbacks, bribes to public officials, consumer fraud, or violations of labor codes, violations of workplace safety and environmental laws. In recent years, General Electric was convicted of 282 counts of contract fraud and fined $20 million. GTE, Boeing, RCA, Hughes Aircraft all pleaded guilty to felony charges. Dell Electronics was fined almost $4 million for deliberately concealing flaws in military electronic equipment. Eastern Airlines pleaded guilty to criminal charges of falsifying aircraft maintenance records. How secure does that make you feel when you fly? Prudential Securities agreed to pay $90 million in restitutions and fines because of widespread fraud. Ashland Oil was fined $2.2 million for dumping massive amounts of diesel fuel into the Ohio River and contaminating the water supplies of several cities. U.S. Steel pleaded no contest to charges of illegally dumping toxic wastes. Litton Industries agreed to pay almost $4 million in fines and civil claims in a federal fraud case. Not one of the executives involved in these crimes went to jail, not even for a day. And this involves millions of dollars more than what ordinary crooks can ever lay their hands on. As at the end of last year, there were 2,729 people on death row in the United States. They had killed only a few more than their own number, using knives, guns, and the like. Had they used lethal industrial chemicals, or mislabeled pharmaceutical drugs, or defective manufactured automobiles, or dangerous consumer devices, or illegally dumped toxic wastes, or unsafe work conditions, as the corporations have, if they had used those things, they could have killed and crippled tens of thousands more without ever going to prison. For example, Honeywell ignored defects in gas heaters, resulting in 22 deaths. It was fined $800,000. Johns Manville suppressed information about the asbestos poisonings of its workers. When ordered to pay damages in civil court, it declared bankruptcy to avoid payment. SmithKline failed to tell the Food and Drug Administration that hundreds of users of one of its drugs had suffered kidney and liver damages, and 36 had died. General Motors produced a pickup truck with a dangerously faulty gas tank design. The Center for Auto Safety reported that 300 people had died in GM pickup fires since 1973. In none of these cases did those responsible for the deaths and disabilities go to jail. Corporate executives almost never are incarcerated for the felonies they commit. An executive of Eli Lilly pleaded no contest for failing to inform the government about the effects of Oriflex, a drug suspected of causing 49 deaths in the USA and several hundred abroad. He was fined $15,000. When a worker was killed because of unsafe standards at the Phillips Petroleum plant in Pasadena, Texas, the company was fined $720. W.R. Grace pleaded guilty to having lied to the Environmental Protection Agency about dumping toxic chemicals into well water, subsequently linked to 8 leukemia deaths. Grace was fined $10,000. In child labor violations involving death or permanent injury, the average fine is, ready, $750, and no one goes to jail in any of these instances. After being charged with unlawfully burning toxic wastes into the atmosphere for 20 years, Potomac Electric Power Company of Washington, D.C. was fined, ready, $500. When Firestone pleaded guilty to filing false tax returns, concealing over $12 million in income, and conspiring to obstruct legal audits of its accounts, it was fined the grand sum of $10,000, and no one went to jail. In 1990, the average fine of 97 major corporate offenders was $183,000. Even when the fine is substantially more, it usually represents a fraction of company profits and fails to compensate for the damage wreaked. Rockwell International agreed to pay a seemingly hefty $18.5 million after pleading guilty to 5 felonies for radioactive and chemical contamination at the Rocky Flats nuclear bomb plant. But the actual cleanup will cost the government and the taxpayers billions of dollars. Over several years, Food Lion cheated its employees of at least $200 million by forcing them to work off the clock. But in a court settlement, the company paid back only $13 million, pocketing the other $187 million. Who says crime doesn't pay? Penalties often go uncollected. Protex Industries was fined $7.5 million for endangering workers at a hazardous waste site, but the fine was later suspended. The General Accounting Office, which is the investigative agency of Congress and probably the best unit in our government, discovered that the Justice Department had not collected some $7 billion in fines and restitutions from corporations and individuals convicted of felonies. More than 100 savings and loan plea bargainers who escaped long prison terms by promising to make penalty repayments of over $133 million repaid less than 1% of that amount. Former Deputy Chief of Staff to President Reagan, Michael Deaver, found guilty of lying under oath about his influence peddling, was sentenced to 3 years in prison. But the entire sentence was then suspended. Deaver was also fined $100,000, but a year later he had not paid a cent. As the Deaver case suggests, on the relatively rare occasions that white-collar criminals are given prison terms, the sentence is usually light and often not even served. The S&L defendants who actually went to prison spent fewer months behind bars on average than car thieves, and at relatively comfortable minimum security prisons, and they had stole hundreds of millions of dollars. Sentenced to 5 years for her role in a $165 million financial swindle in California, Beverly Haynes spent only 67 days behind bars. Wall Street investor Michael Milken pleaded guilty to 6 security violations and was sentenced to 10 years. This was reduced to 22 months, most of which was spent doing community service. Milken paid back about $1 billion to settle criminal and civil charges, but he retained a vast fortune of $1.2 billion from his dealings. Likewise, after paying his fine for insider trading and doing a brief spell behind bars, Ivan Boesky was left with $25 million. Every major participant in these Wall Street investment crimes emerged from the experience as a wealthy man. Again, who says crime doesn't pay? Many major white-collar crimes are not even prosecuted. All three of President Bush's sons were implicated in very shady deals, but none was indicted. The government failed to pursue more than 1,000 fraud and embezzlement cases involving S&L associations and banks, amounting to billions of dollars in losses to U.S. taxpayers. The government claimed it didn't have enough investigators and lawyers. Who you are may be more important than what offense you commit. A public defense attorney who specializes in juvenile cases notes that youngsters from well-to-do families who get into minor scrapes with the law are turned over to their parents with a warning to stay out of trouble. But when the same incidents happen in the less affluent neighborhoods, children are arrested and charged and brought to court. Arrest situations often have enough ambiguity to allow authorities some discretion in determining charges. Whether a situation is treated as disorderly conduct or assault may depend on how the law enforcers feel about the suspect's social status or race. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black once noted that there can be no equal justice when the kind of trial a man gets depends on the amount of money he has. Legal service in our society best serves those who can buy it. The corporate executive with a team of high-powered attorneys experiences a different treatment from the law than the poor person with an underpaid and understaffed court-appointed lawyer who is granted only minimal investigative funds and who sees the defendant for the first time on the day of the trial. Numerous states grant little or no funds for appeals. This means a penniless individual will have a difficult time appealing a harsh sentence or unfair trial. In many states, prospective jurors are chosen from voter registration rolls, county tax lists, or residency lists that underrepresent racial minorities, women, young people, laborers, and the poor. The rich person's lawyers check the backgrounds of prospective jurors to make informed challenges against those who might prove unsympathetic. The poor person's court-appointed lawyer usually has neither the time nor the resources for such investigations. At arraignment, judges have the option of doing anything from releasing the accused on their own recognizance to imposing a bail high enough to keep them in jail until the date of the trial, which may not come for many months. Studies show that judges are far more likely to deny pretrial release to indigent people than to respectable, affluent individuals. And they're more inclined to persuade a poor person to waive the right to counsel and plead guilty. Judges more often incarcerate poorly educated, low-income persons and less often give them suspended sentences or probation than better educated, higher-income persons convicted of the same or more serious crimes. Consider these instances of racial and class bias. A judge imposed a small fine on a stockbroker who made $20 million in illegal market manipulations, and on the same day sentenced an unemployed African-American man to 1 year in jail for stealing a $100 television set from a truck shipment. A man in Houston, Texas, convicted of tampering with his electric meter, costing the power company $1,000 in lost revenues and slightly damaging the meter, was sentenced to 40 years in prison. The trick is to steal big. Two wealthy contractors who pocketed over $1 million in government contracts for work they never did were ordered to pay $5,000 in fines and do 200 hours of community service. But a Norfolk, Virginia man got 10 years for stealing 87 cents. A youth in Louisiana received 50 years for selling a few ounces of marijuana. a Houston youth was sentenced to 50 years for robbing two people of a dollar as they left a restaurant. A five-time petty offender in Dallas was sentenced to 1,000 years in prison for stealing $73. A man caught trying to break into a house in Florida, thus violating his probation for shoplifting a pair of shoes, was sentenced to life in prison. Such instances should remind us that this society is not soft on crime, as some conservatives claim. Nor do offenders go free in undue numbers. In New York City, considered one of the more lenient criminal justice systems, about 9 of every 10 suspects arrested for robbery are convicted, and most are incarcerated. Recent studies find that criminals are getting sentences averaging twice as long as in earlier years. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with some 1.2 million people in jail, and more than twice that number on probation. In the last 20 years, the number of inmates has tripled. Prisons are anything but correctional institutions. Most of them remain overcrowded breeding grounds for disease, rape, murder, and suicide. Prisoners often endure terrorization and physical torture from guards and other prisoners, and protracted confinement in filthy, lightless cells. Some are forced by authorities to take powerful, body-racking, mind-altering drugs. Prisoners who protest such treatment risk being subjected to harsh retribution. There now exist super-security prisons designed to minimize human contact and maximize sensory deprivation. These high-tech dungeons have increased rather than reduced the level of violence and abuse. Prisoners in such special control units never see daylight nor breathe fresh air. They live under constant electronic monitoring, isolated in bare concrete cells. They may not decorate their white cell walls. They're denied classes, books, counseling, religious services, communal activities, and hobbies. They must eat in their cells and are not allowed to speak to anyone who passes by. And they are repeatedly harassed, taunted, and severely beaten for infractions of trivial and inconsistent rules. Consequently, some suffer serious physical or psychological deterioration and retreat into madness. Delusional prisoners are put on psychiatric medication and subjected to a still greater frequency of abuse. The criminal enforcement system is not only unjust, it is highly fallible. Too frequently, the guilty go free while the innocent are incarcerated. In hundreds of documented cases, the wrong person is arrested and convicted. A compelling argument against capital punishment, against the death penalty, is that it assumes the infallibility of a very fallible enforcement process, tainted by coerced confessions, mistaken identification, perjury, overzealous law officers, suppression of troublesome evidence, and fabrication of false evidence, incompetent defense, and rampant class and racial prejudices of judges and juries. Of the people on death row, some are mentally ill and retarded. 10% are without counsel, and almost all the rest have court-appointed lawyers. A disproportionate number are African Americans charged with killing whites. Prosecutors are far more likely to seek the death penalty if the victim is white, and white murderers are significantly more likely to have their death sentences commuted than are black murderers. Almost all death row inmates are low income and working class, whether they're white, black, or Latino. As Justice William Douglas noted, the death penalty is selectively applied against those who are poor and politically powerless. Scores of demonstrably innocent people have been executed in the United States since 1900. There are studies on this, and hundreds have been wrongly convicted of capital crimes. In just one corner of New Jersey alone, a clergyman managed to get authorities to release three men wrongly convicted of capital crimes who had served many years behind bars. Now, if they and hundreds like them had been executed instead of giving prison terms, there would have been no opportunity to reopen their cases and demonstrate their innocence. In brief, poor and working-class persons, the uneducated, and racial minorities are more likely to be arrested, denied bail, induced to plead guilty, and do without a pretrial hearing or adequate representation. They are less likely to have a jury trial if tried, more likely to be convicted and receive a harsh sentence, including the death penalty, and less likely to receive probation or a suspended sentence than are mobsters, business executives, and upper-class whites in general. It has been said the rich have little reason to fear the legal system, and the poor have little reason to respect it. All this is not to suggest that we should be soft on crime. It is no crime to be against crime. Effective law enforcement is needed to protect the public from corporate felons, organized mobsters, murderers, muggers, child abusers, spouse batterers, racists, hate crime perpetrators, and others. But the law frequently fails those most in need of its protection. Women, children, working people, poor people, victims of hate crimes, gays and minorities, and drug victims, and victims of serial murderers, they often don't get the kind of protection that's needed. Take the case of Polly Klass in Petaluma, a 12-year-old girl who was abducted in the middle of the night. The police could not catch her kidnapper. They even had him in their hands and let him go. An all-points bulletin was sent out, and it wasn't sent out, it turns out. The kind of police work done in the Polly Klass case was an utter disgrace. The effort made was almost nil. And yet, as I said at the time, if in that same little town of Petaluma a bank had been robbed, the police would have thrown up blockades and apprehended the robbers in no time. And to prove my point, 10 months later, a bank in Petaluma was robbed. Perhaps the robbers were lured by the lackadaisical Keystone Cop police enforcement in the Klass case. And sure enough, all the roadblocks were put up, police cars and state patrol cars were all over the place, helicopters zoomed in, and within 20 minutes they had caught the bank robbers. So if you rob a bank, you really can be in trouble. A human life, a missing child, is treated in a very lackadaisical way if it's treated or responded to at all. But a bank, property of the property class, that's when the police really get moving. It's an unfortunate thing. Now, some police are aware of the class function they serve. Former Boston Police Commissioner Robert DeGrazia summed it up, and I quote him, "Those who commit the crime which worries citizens most, violent street crime, are, for the most part, the products of poverty, unemployment, broken homes, rotten education, drug addiction, and alcoholism, and other social and economic ills about which the police can do little, if anything." Rather than speaking up, most of us stand silent and let politicians get away with law and order rhetoric that reinforces the mistaken notion that police, in ever greater numbers and with more gadgetry, can alone control crime. Even in the much vaunted war on drugs, one might wish that the law moved more vigorously and in the right direction. The growing prison population consists mostly of petty drug offenders, not violent felons and organized mobsters. The federal prison population has tripled since 1980. Three-quarters of the new arrivals are drug offenders. They face harsh, mandatory sentencing. To illustrate, a California teenager on his way to a rock concert was arrested and sentenced to 15 years without parole for possession of 3 grams of LSD, and hallucinogen. If he'd been carrying his LSD in sugar cubes or orange juice, thereby increasing its weight, he would have received life without parole. In Texas, a young man with less than a gram of LSD got 20 years without parole in federal prison. In Michigan, possession of cocaine has sent first offenders to jail for life without parole. First offenders in nonviolent drug cases average more jail time than murderers or other violent criminals with long records. The war on drugs, in other words, is principally a war on drug victims, leaving the well-connected big narcotics cartels largely untouched. Little has been done to stop the laundering of drug money through established financial institutions or to prevent U.S. companies from selling the precursor chemicals used in cocaine production. Legislation exists in both instances, but it remains virtually unenforced. The Reagan and Bush administrations talked a tough line, but drastically cut the Drug Enforcement Agency's investigative staff and halted law enforcement efforts to keep narcotics out of the United States. Profits from the drug trade have been used by the CIA to fund right-wing mercenary wars against progressive governments, as in Nicaragua. The politicians, of course, end up perpetuating a system by which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and crime continues. And that might be my final word about white-collar crime and street crime. We should be aware of how they're interrelated. The poor get poorer because the rich get richer. The white-collar corporate investors take a terrible toll on society, especially upon those who are least able to defend themselves. They help create the very want, scarcity, injustice, and maldistribution that contributes to so much street crime. If it is true that we need more law and order, more respect for other people's rights, then we should start at the top, vigorously applying the law to those who try to grab everything for themselves, regardless of the social costs, the illegalities, and the ruinous effects on others.
You heard Justice for Sale, part two in a series of 12 commentaries by political analyst Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is the author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. For a copy of this talk and one other by Michael Parenti, please send $4 for one cassette and ask for Part 2, Justice for Sale. For the entire 12-part series on 6 cassettes, send $24, that's 6 cassettes for $24, to People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA. That's People's Video Audio,